today on Against the Grain, how does power in this country operate, and what aspects of it tend to be ignored, and with what consequences? The power wielded by Wall Street, by the police, and by authoritarian political figures was the focus of three talks given at this year's American Sociological Association annual meeting. I'm CS. We'll present portions of talks given by three prominent scholar activists, Walden Bellow, Kimberly Crenshaw, and Miriam Kaba, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. The structural power of banks and finance capital more generally. The use of violence by police against black women. The use of torture by police in Chicago and a push for reparations. These and other issues were addressed in a set of talks given at the annual meeting of the American Sociological Association in August. Today we present portions of three talks given by a trio of prominent figures in ongoing struggles for social and political justice. Later this hour you'll hear from Kimberly Crenshaw, professor of law at both UCLA and Columbia, leading scholar of critical race theory, and the person who coined the term intersectionality. We'll also bring you portions of a talk by Miriam Kaba, a veteran organizer, educator, and curator whose work focuses on, among other things, transformative justice and dismantling the prison-industrial complex. We begin with Walden Bellow, a leading intellectual critic of neoliberal globalization and a sociology professor at the State University of New York at Binghamton. Bellow received the Right Livelihood Award, also known as the Alternative Nobel Prize, in 2003. He's also a veteran human rights activist in the Philippines, where he was born. At the ASA annual meeting, Walden Bellow spoke at a plenary session about a variety of issues, including the power of Wall Street and the Trump phenomenon. Here are portions of Bellow's talk delivered on August 19th of this year.
When the ground from under Wall Street opened up in the autumn of 2008, there was much talk of letting the banks get their just desserts, jailing the banksters, and imposing draconian regulation. The newly elected Barack Obama came to power promising banking reform, warning Wall Street, and I quote, "My administration is the only thing that stands between you and the pitchforks," unquote. Yet, nearly 8 years after the outbreak of the global financial crisis, it is evident that those who are responsible for bringing it about have managed to go completely scot-free. Not only that, they have been able to get governments to stick the cost of the crisis and the burden of the recovery on their victims. How did they succeed? The first line of defense for the banks was to get the government to rescue the banks from the financial mess that they had created. The banks flatly refused Washington's pressure on them to mount a collective defense with their own resources. Using the massive collapse of stock prices triggered by Lehman Brothers going under, finance capital's representatives were able to blackmail both liberals and the far right in Congress to approve the U.S. $700 billion troubled asset relief program. Nationalization of the banks was dismissed as being inconsistent with American values. Then, by engaging in the defensive anti-regulatory war that they had mastered in Congress over decades, the banks were able, in 2009 and 2010, to gut the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of three key items that were seen as necessary for genuine reform: downsizing the banks, institutionally separating commercial from investment banking, and effectively regulating the so-called shadow banking system that had brought on the crisis. They did this by using what Cornelia Wall termed finance capital's structural power. One dimension of this power was the $344 million that the industry lobbying the U.S. Congress in the first 9 months of 2009 when legislators were taking up financial reform. Senator Chris Dodd, the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, alone received $2.8 million in contributions from Wall Street in 2007 and 2008. But perhaps equally as powerful as Wall Street's entrenched congressional lobby were powerful voices in the new Obama administration who were sympathetic to the bankers, notably Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and Council of Economic Advisors head Larry Summers, both of whom had served as close associates of Robert Rubin, who had successive incarnations as co-chairman of Goldman Sachs, Bill Clinton's Treasury Chief, and chairman and senior counselor of Citigroup. Finally, the financial sector succeeded by hitching the defense of its interests to one of the few remaining resonant assumptions of an otherwise crumbling neoliberal ideology, that the state is the source of all things bad that happen in the economy. While benefiting from the government bailout, Wall Street was able to change the narrative about the causes of the financial crisis, throwing the blame entirely on the state. This is best illustrated in the case of Europe. As in the United States, the financial crisis was a supply-driven crisis as the big European banks sought high-profit, quick-return substitutes for the low returns on investment in industry and agriculture, such as real estate lending and speculation in financial derivatives, or placed their surplus funds in high-yield bonds sold by governments. Indeed, in their drive to raise more and more profits from lending to the government, local banks and property developers, Europe's banks poured $2.5 trillion into Ireland, Greece, Portugal, and Spain. The result was that Greece's debt-to-GDP ratio rose 148% in 2010, bringing the country to the brink of a sovereign debt crisis. Focused on protecting the banks, the European authorities' approach to stabilizing finances was not to penalize the creditors for irresponsible lending, but to get citizens to shoulder all the costs of adjustment. This change narrative focused on the profligate state rather than unregulated private finance as the cause of the financial crisis quickly made its way to the United States, where it was used not only to derail banking reform, but also prevent the enactment of an effective stimulus program in 2010. Christina Romer, the former head of Barack Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, estimated that it would take $1.8 trillion to reverse the recession. Obama approved only less than half, or $787 billion, placating the Republican opposition but preventing an early recovery. Thus, the cost of the follies of Wall Street fell not on banks, but on ordinary Americans, with the unemployed reaching nearly 10% of the workforce in 2011 and youth unemployment reaching over 20%. The triumph of Wall Street in reversing that popular surge against it following the outbreak of the crisis is evident in the run-up to the 2016 presidential elections. The U.S. statistics are clear: 95% of income gains from 2009 to 2010 went to the top 1%. Median income was $4,000 lower in 2014 than in 2000, and concentration of financial assets increased after 2009, with the four largest banks owning assets that came to nearly 50% of gross domestic product. Yet, regulating Wall Street has not been an issue in the Republican primary debates, while in the Democratic debates, it has been a side issue, despite the valiant efforts of candidate Bernie Sanders to make it the centerpiece issue. The political institutions of one of the world's most advanced liberal democracies were no match for the entrenched structural power of the financial establishment. As Cornelia Wall writes, and I quote, "For the administration and Congress, the main lesson from the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009 was that they had only very limited means to pressure the financial industry into behavior that appeared urgently necessary for the survival of the entire sector and the economy as a whole," unquote. In Greece, the austerity policies provoked a popular revolt expressed in the June 2015 referendum on the bailout, in which over 60% of the Greek people rejected the deal. But in the end, their will was trampled on as the German government forced the Greek Prime Minister Tsipras into a humiliating surrender. It is clear that the key motives were to save the European financial elite from the consequences of their irresponsible policies, enforcing the iron principle of full debt repayment and crucifying Greece to dissuade others, such as the Spaniards, Irish, and the Portuguese, from revolting against debt slavery. As Carlo Otto Pohl, a former head of Germany's Bundesbank, admitted some time back, the draconian exercise in Greece was about, quote, "protecting German banks, but especially the French banks, from debt write-offs, unquote. But taming the profligate state has been the articulated rationale. Yet, the victory of the banks is likely, in the end, to be Pyrrhic. The combination of deep austerity-induced recession or stagnation that grips much of Europe and the United States and the absence of financial reform is deadly. The question, then, is not if another bubble will burst, but when. And for us here, the key lesson is that in spite of the ideological discrediting of neoliberalism and popular anger at the depredation of the banks, the structural power of capital remains immense and has prevented any significant financial figure from being jailed, much less allowed significant reform. My sense is that the persistence of capital structural power is related to the fact that while the combination of objective developments, intellectual critique, and collective action eroded the legitimacy of neoliberalism, we have had a signal failure to articulate the bold alternative that can match the depth of the crisis of capitalism that we are in. There is great seething discontent out there at the multiple crises triggered by capitalism. I wish, however, one could say, as Mao did, and I quote, "There is great tumult under heaven. The situation is excellent," end quote. Unfortunately, the situation is not excellent, since many of those who have been run over by corporate-driven globalization are turning to demagogues and ideologues of the right, such as Donald Trump, Marine Le Pen in France, and in my own country, President Rodrigo Duterte, who has managed to convince a large section of the citizenry that crime and drugs are the root of the country's problems, and the main cure for the ills of the country is to kill them all, pushers and users alike. In this regard, let me say that the United States and Europe have no monopoly on dangerous right-wing demagogues with a heated, angry mass base. A great many of them resentful people from the lower middle classes who want simple solutions, and many of whom are willing to countenance violence to bring about the leader's version of heaven on earth. Undoubtedly, part of the problem is the failure of the traditional forces of the left to educate their core bases of support, such as the white working class. Another part has been the inability to integrate minority populations into the ranks of the left, which has traditionally been the home of the disenfranchised and marginalized, forcing some to turn to radical fundamentalist groups such as ISIS. Thus, the very real hurts imposed on so many sectors by corporate-driven globalization have been successfully joined to myths about displacement and crime by immigrants, on the one hand, and to the very real failures of immigration integration, on the other. Donald Trump, Marine Le Pen, and ISIS have been very astute in taking advantage of the openings that were made by the left, by those who brought about the Seattle debacle of neoliberalism, by those who had been on the forefront of the anti-globalization and the Occupy movement. These people have been eating our lunch. I will not go further into the sociological reasons for their success and our failure so far, since many others have done that. But I do want to raise one question, and that is whether it is not overdue for us to take on the super ambitious task of creating that overarching vision, language, and program to spell out the alternative and flesh it out. Bernie Sanders started this brave task by calling for democratic socialism, something that has resonated in the Philippines and the global south. I think it is urgent that we flesh it out, since the other side is already fleshing out their alternative in the form of Trumpism or National Frontism or Brexitism, a task which marries some of our intellectual critique of capitalism with the highly charged emotional appeal to return to an idealized past of white homogeneity, cultural purity, or religious uniformity. I think it is urgent that we overcome our fears of articulating grand narratives and lay out a vision that lays out the overcoming of the present world blighted by capital through common struggle, with the end being the construction of societies that harness men and women's deepest instinct, to use a loaded word, that is cooperation. Needless to say, such an endeavor must also be one that acknowledges the limitations, failures, and distortions of past efforts at building post-capitalist societies, especially when it came to dealing with issues of gender, democracy, and the environment. I'm not usually a Bible-quoting speaker, but there's definitely something profound in the passage in Proverbs 29:18, quote, "Where there is no vision, the people perish," end quote. It would be tragic if people were left to the phlegmatic alternatives posed by the historically bypassed social democrats in Europe, the tiresome Clintons in the United States, and uninspiring elite-run reform movements in the global South. Such political alternatives are no match for the counter-revolutionary movements that are on the march.
That was Walden Bellow speaking in August at the American Sociological Association annual meeting in Seattle. Walden Bellow is a human rights activist, a sociologist at the State University of New York at Binghamton, and the author of numerous books, including Food Wars, Capitalism's Last Stand, with a question mark, and Dragons in Distress, Asia's Miracle Economies in Crisis. Bellow is spelled B-E-L-L-O. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We turn now to remarks made at another plenary session at the ASA annual meeting, remarks made by Kimberly Crenshaw. Crenshaw is professor of law at UCLA and Columbia. She is a leading scholar of critical race theory and co-founder of the African American Policy Forum. She is also involved with an initiative called Say Her Name, which you will hear about shortly. Kimberly Crenshaw spoke at a panel called Protesting Racism on August 20th. Here are portions of her presentation.
This is a moment where what had been called the end of race with the election of Barack Obama is now concluding with a level of racial demagoguery and violence that we haven't seen, some say decades, I would say generations. At the same time, resistance too, and by resistance, I mean Black Lives Matter. I mean all of the ways that we have pushed back against this attempt to erase race has sometimes been met with claims that we are engaging in racial grievance politics, that we are making race consistently salient, that we are not moving in the spirit of post-racialism. So what is particularly exciting about this moment is I think it's clear that post-racialism is over. And now the question is, what period are we in now? So some people would say that we are returning to a period before the purple haze of post-racialism. I'd want to say that we're in a post-post-racial moment. So there really is a morning after, and it's not pretty. So the question is, what do we make of this ideological moment? What do we make of this protest within this ideological moment? And one thing that I think is clear is that it constitutes a repudiation of the embargo on race talk, race agitation, racial protesting. It is a moment where we're moving away from that particular mistake. But it's also important that as we move away from that mistaken notion that we're post-racial, that we acknowledge that not all race talk had been embargoed even during that post-racial moment. Right? So we can see it in the presidential campaign even now. There is race talk still going on among those who claim to be colorblind or among those who claim to be post-racial. If we look at any social problem that we have, including the problem of state police violence, you will have those who will use race talk to justify what's happening. Race talk is race talk that claims that the problems in African American communities are problems having to do with poor values, lack of investment in future behavior, failure to pull up pants, failure to have full nuclear family formations, all of these, or listening to the wrong music, All of these have been used as justifications for the level of violence, the level of disparity, the level of marginalization of Black communities from the community. So this is basically race talk without racism. When racial difference is talked about, without racial power being part of it, it is an equation that amounts to the problem is an individual level problem. It is a group problem. It's a cultural problem. It is not a structural problem. It is not an institutional problem. So we are witnessing in this moment the return of very old and long-standing ideas about inherent inequalities of Black peoples and Black communities. And these ideas have pushed up against efforts to reform and make our society into a racial equitable one. Now, that much goes, I think, pretty much without saying, although it took me about 3 minutes to say it. But what I want to say is that the current crises around racial inequality is not simply the product of racial intolerance having overcome the forces that have been mobilizing for racial justice. What I want to suggest is that they are ideologically and materially, at least in part, the product of a very successful counter-reform effort in the law that has so grossly undermined demands for structural reform that we've even lost sense in popular discourse about the difference between an institutional level kind of intervention and individual level interventions. So, for example, that we can even possibly have a conversation about a program like My Brother's Keeper in the context of a conversation about racial terrorism against Black people is evidence of the fact that we do not have a structural analysis and that much of what counts as racial policy intervention is more at the level of the individual and the cultural, not the level at which we need it. Now, I would submit that what this is a conversation about is the way that police violence that's permitted to continue when the constitutional and legal rules are largely not providing any kind of prophylactic protection, when that problem is completely off the table. And so if you look at the conversations that we've had about police violence, you look, for example, at the recent town hall with the president, what was not discussed was structural reform. What was not discussed was constitutional rulemaking. What was not discussed was a version of democracy that allows the majority to create the kind of police force they want, and not a police force that has anything to do with equity. When we can't have those kind of conversations, we are not yet in a moment where we've gotten beyond this post-racial haze. So some part of this is rethinking what's off the table and figuring out how to put them back in the table. And the other part of it goes to what principally I want to talk about now, and it's the way that the prevailing frames around racism continue to center masculinity as the essential geography of racial power. And that centering continues to limit the scope of social justice transformation. Now, this current movement, in particular, the imperative of Black Lives Matter, simply, powerfully, and uncompromisingly contests the socially explicit meaning of this retrenchment that I've described. It's a bold reframing of the colorblind imperative that reveals what its deadly consequences have been. Yet I want to say that the challenge remains, how do we go about engendering this discourse? Everyone knows that police killings of African Americans have been on the forefront of the conversation about racial inequality for at least the last 2 years. Yet, Black women face a long and tragic history of racialized violence, including the risk of sexual abuse by officers and death at the hands of vigilantes and intimates alike. Conversely, The narrowed scope of their visibility and the salience of what has happened to Black women undermines our ability to have a broad, inclusive set of demands around state violence. Little is known about the scope of the sorts of vulnerabilities that make Black women subject to this kind of violence, and it rarely reaches the level of salience that is sufficient to galvanize resistance in their names. Now, we know that these tragedies have been framed in fairly predictable ways, but what's interesting is they're framed in that way both by critics and by those who are contesting state violence. Now, this challenge about how to rethink and how to reframe this issue is one that goes beyond our individual orientation. It goes beyond our commitment to anti-racism and beyond our commitment to feminism. It's part of a social, cultural attribution of meaning that we all are part of. So in that spirit, I want to provoke us to take a full measure of what we don't see and what we do see, and why we have to say her name.
At this point in her talk, Kimberly Crenshaw told the audience that she'd say a number of names and asked that people signal whether they've heard of each of them. The names she said were in order: Mike Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Freddie Gray, Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, Maya Hall, Tanisha Anderson, Natasha McKenna, Era Russer, Jessica Williams, and Megan Hockaday. We now pick back up with Crenshaw's talk.
So we all know the names of the first six names. They are African-American men who have been killed by police within the last 2 years. What we also did not know is that the names of the women that I mentioned were all women who were killed within days, sometimes weeks, of the men whose names you did know. All killed by the police. Now, the fact that we didn't know them, that very few of us knew more than two or three of them, doesn't necessarily tell us or constitute a testament about whether we care or not. It's evidence of the ways that the framing of an issue, particularly its representative subjects, constitutes powerful narratives. It shapes the way we think and the way we talk and the way we move in response to a particular issue. It means that those who consider ourselves to be part of the community of resistance have to make the critical effort to disrupt the practice of reading out the bodies of Black women, girls, and femmes. So our Say Her Name symbol is a word puzzle, in part because we want to signify that this involves the work of critical seeing, a commitment to sorting out the names of those who've been lost between the narrative lines of anti-Black police violence. So you actually have to look into the word puzzle to find those names. Now, knowing their names is a necessary but not sufficient condition to lifting up their stories, which in turn provides a sharper view of the wide-ranging circumstances that make Black bodies disproportionately subject to state violence. To lift their stories, though, we need to know who they are, how they lived, and why they suffered at the hands of police. Now, the clearest illustration of the vulnerability of Black women and girls is that so many of those names are unknown even to us who care deeply about this issue. It's a vicious cycle that leads too many of us to assume that because their names are not known, women and girls are not at risk. Yet girls as young as 7 and as old as 93, women as old as 93, have been killed by the police. They've been killed in their living rooms and on the streets, in their cars and in their bedrooms, in front of their children and in front of parents. They have been killed when they or their family members have sought help. They have been killed when men they were with were targeted. They've been killed when they were alone. They have been killed driving while Black, shopping while Black, being homeless while Black, having a mental disability while Black, having a domestic dispute while Black. They've been killed using a cell phone, turning into an NSA parking lot, driving near the White House with an infant strapped in the back seat, and sitting in a car reported as stolen. That they are women does virtually nothing to counter the excuses that were given for the use of deadly force against them. They've been described by police as possessing superhuman strength, as being utterly tireless, as wordlessly posing a mortal threat to the officers by simply the look on their faces. No matter their physical or mental condition, their age, or circumstance, they were never seen as damsels in distress, or women in crisis, or being a woman who is distraught or who is in fear. They were instead regarded to be out of control figures that warranted violent suppression and punishment. Now, this vulnerability to police violence is an experience that they do share with Black men. And like their male counterparts, their children will cry for them, their parents and family will mourn them, and the officers that stole their lives will most probably escape accountability for taking them. What they do not share in common with their fallen brothers is the fact that their loss of life will garner the public attention, communal outcry, or political response that others have. There were no mass demonstrations over the death of Natasha McKenna, even though her institutionalized killing at the hands of six officers who swarmed, shackled, hooded, and tasered her four times was filmed and released to the public, supposedly to affirm the claim that the officers operated in an entirely professional manner. Virtually no one knows the name of Tanisha Anderson, who was killed by the Cleveland police a little more than a week before the tragic death of Tamir Rice. There's been no sustained advocacy for Maya Hall, who in Baltimore was killed by the NSA just days before Freddie Gray. Jessica Williams is a mother of five and pregnant with her sixth. She's also a woman who died 4 weeks before Philando Castile after what police claim was her attempt to get away in a stolen car. But her name has not been mentioned among the African Americans recently killed by the police. And most recently, Corinne Gaines, who was shot by a SWAT team in Baltimore after they cut her Facebook broadcast. She's also not usually mentioned in the roll call of the dead. So, will the frame of racialized state violence ever be capacious enough to fully acknowledge those lost lives and to demand the public's burning demand for accountability? These were some of the questions burning in our souls when many of us marched in the protests over Eric Garner. And like others, we called out the names of Mike Brown and Tamir Rice and Eric Garner, but we also called the names of Ara Russer and Michelle Cousseau. And we urge others to say these names with us. Ultimately, with Andrea Ritchie, we wrote a report to provide those names and to open up the frames to understand and to hold their stories. So say her name grew out of that moment as an imperative, a plea, a demand, a reminder that women and girls are beaten, maimed, shocked, shoved, and shot, and sexually abused as well. In fact, sexual abuse is the second most common complaint against the police, yet until recently, it has been virtually absent in most discourses about police violence and in discourses about violence against women as well. It is, of course, both, just as discrimination against Black women is both race and gender discrimination. But the conventional ways of locating the problem of sexual abuse in the private arena and police abuse in the public arena essentially erases the ways that marginalized women are subject to sexual abuse by officers of the state. Now, the case of Daniel Holzclaw, I hope many of you have heard about it by now, in Oklahoma City, illustrates how the intersectional vulnerability of socially marginalized women renders them vulnerable to sexual abuse by cop, and how conventional rhetorics about racialized state violence obscure the problem. Evidence that led to his conviction for assaulting eight Black women demonstrated that he profiled Black women while driving or walking, pulled them over, as the Supreme Court allows him to do, and then force them to perform specific acts, which the Supreme Court does not allow to do. At least 13 women testified that this had happened to him. Those who were particularly vulnerable were those with a history of system involvement, involvement in the sex trade, chemical dependency, or poor. As his defense strategy made clear, these women were those who were unlikely to call police, and they knew that they wouldn't be believed even if they did. So Holzklaw was sentenced to 263 years, but this individual outcome shouldn't obscure the fact that the case received very little coverage in the mainstream media, nor was it a site that drew the attention of national feminists or anti-racist protests. The recent report from the Department of Justice cast some light on police abuse of sexual assault victims and the harassment of transgender women in Baltimore, but even this report says little about the police as agents of sexual abuse or about Black women as particularly vulnerable populations. And while we're thinking about it, let's just think more broadly about what we know about Black women as victims of homicide. How many of us know the name of Ted Bundy? How many of us know the name of Lonnie Franklin Jr.? Lonnie Franklin Jr. was just convicted 2 weeks ago of the homicide of 10 Black women in Los Angeles. Estimates are that he probably killed more than 35 to 50 women. We don't know anything about this, right? Again, a particular way in which framing of certain issues excludes women who are subject to intersectional erasure. So this intersectional vulnerability and political marginalization of Black women is nothing new. Beth Ritchie, for example, in her powerful book, Arrested Justice, provides a powerful portrait of the particular vulnerabilities that befall Black women as a consequence of the withdrawal of public resources, the abandonment of social supports, and the unleashing of the police to pretty much operate in the way they choose. These consequences are not unlike the picture painted by Danny McGuire's excellent portrayal of Rosa Parks' activism on behalf of Black women sexually abused in the rural South during the dawn of the civil rights movement. Ritchie, McGuire, and others point out the realities that racial justice has never been exclusively gendered as male, nor has the struggle for it. But to deploy an age-old aphorism, does racial injustice without a frame make a sound? And if not, how do we speak it? There are any number of implications that can be drawn from this marginalized space with respect to research priorities, activism, and policy demands. It's all important work. It's work we all do. But there's still a sense that there's something fundamentally missing, a level of urgency that's difficult to muster. It's as if the voices that would call out to us are muffled, either by our own inability to hear or to see the cumulative reality and the cost of this violence. Some would say that the killings and abuse of Black women are just not observable because there aren't videos of it, and thus it's not mobilizing. But this pales beside the video of Natasha McKenna. In this cold, sterile, institutionalized setting, there was something enervating, an inability to read what we were seeing inside the emotionally resonant frames of other tortures, like what happened in Abu Ghraib, or what happened to Mike Brown, or what happened historically with lynchings. So one of the things that my colleagues and I tried to do was to reframe it, to give the cues, to say this is what's happening here. But in doing so, we discovered that indeed there are dozens of images online that captures violence against Black women.
That was Kimberly Crenshaw speaking in August in Seattle. Crenshaw is professor of law at UCLA and Columbia. She is a leading scholar of critical race theory, and she coined the term intersectionality. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We now turn to another featured speaker at the same plenary session. Maryam Kaba is a veteran organizer, educator, and curator whose work focuses on, among other things, transformative justice and dismantling the prison industrial complex. She is the founder and director of Project NIA, a grassroots organization with a vision to end youth incarceration, and she's also a member and co-founder of We Charge Genocide. Here's Maryam Kaba speaking at the annual meeting of the American Sociological Association on August 20th of this year.
I'm going to talk today specifically about a reparations campaign, what we call Reparations Now or ROMREP Now, a campaign that I helped to co-lead that led last year to that the Chicago City Council passed the first ever law that gave reparations to police torture survivors. Thanks. I think I want to talk specifically about the reparations ordinance and the work on reparations in the context of this movement for Black Lives that's the current reiteration, as Charlene says, of a movement that's a movement of longstanding, a movement that has been going on for decades and generations, and that has its iteration today in a new kind of way, but is still part of that long line. And I think the reparations fight is an example, a concrete example of how that worked and how that has worked. I also want to say that right now, the way that the story has gotten told or is getting told about how the movement for Black Lives has advanced is in part that the movement doesn't have any demands, that movement doesn't have any wins, that people don't really know what they are trying to fight for. All of the things that Charlene brought to bear in terms of showing that that is not actually the case. But I think there's also another thing, which is that people seem not to understand that the movement is actually a set of decentralized movements. That the way that it looks in Oakland is different from the way it looks in DC, is different from the way it looks in Nashville, and is different from the way it looks in Chicago. And that if you look at it as some one thing with three people at the head of it, that you're missing completely what's happening, that you have no clue what's happening, you can't really describe it to anybody with any sort of authority. So I'm gonna talk specifically about Chicago right now, because for me, Chicago is kind of the epicenter of the actualization of a lot of what the movement for Black Lives wants and is fighting for and has been talking about. And it's a place where we've had a lot of wins, contrary to the way that people have also framed this as a movement without any. So I'm going to talk about the reparations ordinance that came to pass, was introduced in the City Council in 2013. But more than that, it's important for me to go back and tell you a story of kind of John Burge and police torture in Chicago. How many of you have ever heard the name John Burge? Some, but a whole lot of you have not. And that is both by intent, because people wanted to squash the story, but also because we don't think of ourselves as a country where people are tortured by police. We think of ourselves as a country where there's something nebulous called police brutality, which actually has no meaning in and of itself. It's not police brutality, it's police actual torture and violence happening on a regular basis to people on a kind of host of different kinds of canvases and places. But in 1972, there was a first allegation of police torture at a place called Area 2 on the far south side of Chicago. Somebody said that they had basically been literally tortured by Chicago police into giving a confession for a murder that they did not commit. One of the items of that torture that was used is a device that is now termed the nigger box. And the reason it was termed the nigger box was because it was painted black. But what they would do with the nigger box was to attach it to people's extremities, whether it was their ears or their genitals, and then they would turn the crank and electrocute people using that nigger box. We know now that over 118 Black people were tortured by John Burge, a police commander in Area 2, starting in 1972, all the way until 1991, when he was finally removed from his job. He wasn't fired until 1993. They were tortured into giving confessions for crimes that they did not commit. In some cases, few of them, for crimes they actually probably committed. But some of those men, in particular men, were put on death row in Illinois. And they came together as the Death Row 10 to fight for their innocence along with their families. And it was through their activism and the activism of many lawyers and of a particular journalist named John Conroy, who started writing pieces in a publication called the Chicago Reader to expose what had happened with John Burge. It's through them that we finally started to understand what the scope of this torture was. But I think it's important, as we're talking about kind of some of the instruments that were used, here is a particular etching that was made by Andrew Wilson, who wrote that he was etched into the interrogation room using a paper clip, that he was being tortured and that he was admitting that he did this, but he hadn't actually done this. Some of those men who were tortured and on death row were commuted into life sentences after death row was abolished, after Ryan, one of our governors, one of the many that ends up in prison, he went to prison. what ends up happening in this case is that he commutes all of those sentences and those men get life in prison instead, a form of social death anyway. Some of them are still in prison, even to this day, after knowing full well what has happened to them and what happened to them. This is Andrew Wilson, who was the first who took a pro se himself, put himself and tried to fight his case from behind bars. And it was through Andrew Wilson and the People's Law Office that we finally really began to understand the scope of the issue. So I wanted to kind of give you that background and that history to understand that this has been a 40-year struggle for justice for the survivors of police torture in Chicago, and that many different kinds of people were involved. And that by the time it gets to the ROM Rep Now campaign, we are at a point where people have pushed internationally, have gone to the UN, have done all sorts of things to get this issue brought to bear. And that all of a sudden, after many, many years, John Burge in 2010 is convicted of perjury for lying about the torture, but never actually convicted for torture. And the reason that's important is, first, the statute of limitations ran out, but secondly, that after he was convicted, he got 4 years in prison for what happened. A lot of people felt like, what the hell? We fought so hard through the system, and this is what we get as justice? Meanwhile, all the survivors get almost nothing. The statute of limitation has run out for most of them, and they're left completely psychologically tortured still from what they experienced, without any resources, without any help. So what have we been fighting for in the end? So people felt really a sense of kind of depression. And out of that depression came a group of folks called the Chicago Torture Justice Memorials, who put out a call in 2011 to people all across Chicago to say, how would you memorialize the torture that happened here? What are some speculative memorials that we can come up with that would make sure that people know about what happened and that they never forget that this happened? And so through art, the idea of a reparations ordinance emerged. Through art, that's important too, because in our movements, we think about art as superfluous or tangential, when in fact, art is central to our being able to get free. And this experience and this example of people coming together shows the importance of centering art to help us kind of come up with an imagination of things that could be outside of the things we kind of constantly turn to as remedies or redress for violence and for torture. So we end up in a place where we decide in 2014, we're fighting for a lot of things. There's a group that I was part of called We Charge Genocide that decides to take the case of police torture and police violence against young people to the United Nations. So, and we also then, in the summer, in August, Mike Brown is killed. So there's all this stuff swelling in the air and going on, and we're thinking, this is a great moment for us to take this reparations ordinance as something concrete and to demand that the city of Chicago acknowledge the torture that it oversaw and that its gatekeepers actually conducted, and that it's important for us to make sure that these survivors who no longer have legal standing to be able to get redress get some form of redress. And so we came up with this, a person named Joey Mogul, who's amazing, a great lawyer, movement lawyer in Chicago, talked to a bunch of people and came up with an ordinance that said we wanted money for what happened, that we wanted education for the survivors and their families and their grandchildren, and that we wanted opportunities for jobs for those people, and that we wanted a public memorial in Chicago, that we wanted a public apology for what had happened by the mayor and the city council, and that we wanted a whole series of different kinds of redress and remedies that would actually make a difference and that would actually help to kind of repair in some way, to the extent that we could, the harm that had occurred through that torture. And we fought and we won last year. And when I stood at the city council and I saw them apologize to survivors who were young when they tortured them and now who were old men who stood there, I thought to myself, you know, direct organizing gets the goods. It does. It does. It matters. It matters. So the Reparations Now campaign is based on an expansive and transformative vision of justice. And within transformative justice framework, we ask a few questions. We ask what went wrong and what happened. And the excavation of that history that I showed a little part of was part of kind of figuring out what happened and what went wrong. We asked who has been harmed, and we make sure they're centered. And in this case, it was torture survivors that were harmed and their families and their communities. And so throughout the whole entire campaign, led by the Chicago Torture Justice Memorials, Amnesty International came on board to help lead that campaign, Project NIA, and We Charge Genocide. We always centered survivors and their families within the entire campaign. The next question is, how do we repair the harm? And the CTJM ordinance was an example of that. It's also an example for me as an abolitionist of an abolitionist demand and an abolitionist document that we can actually use without relying on these traditional ways that we constantly rely on to try to get justice. It is, in my belief, a futile exercise to continue to press constantly for the prosecutions of the gatekeepers of the state. The state will not tell on itself. It is ridiculous. So that is a hard thing for people to understand, because in this country, everything that happens is, let's put them in jail first and then ask questions later. And to me, that is not going to work. It's not going to yield results, and we are not going to succeed, and we're not going to get free that way. So how do you repair harms? Think about abolitionist demands and documents that can actually get you there. Then finally, the other two are, what can we do to prevent this in the future? And then what is my, meaning my community, state, and country's responsibility to aid in that prevention? So at every level, we asked ourselves these questions, and we let these questions guide us in the campaign.
That's the voice of Miriam Kaba, veteran organizer, educator, and writer, and founder and director of Project NIA. She's also an advisory board member of Chicago Torture Justice Memorials. She studied sociology at McGill University, City College of New York, and Northwestern University. Miriam Kaba spoke at the annual meeting of the American Sociological Association in August. We've put links to information about Miriam Kaba, whose last name is spelled K-A-B-A, Kimberly Crenshaw, Walden Bellow, and the American Sociological Association on our website, againstthegrain.org. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.